who's going to continue in the theme of looking at what we can get from biologically inspired auditory processing. His group's been doing a lot of work on figuring out how you can extract useful features from auditory models that can be used to do interesting tasks, making, in this case, explicit use of sparsity. Thanks, Dick.
Thanks, Josh. Nice to see so many old and new friends here, old friends like Malcolm and new friends like Josh, and so many people attending. The system I'm discussing today and the representations of audio that it uses were reported in considerable detail in, I think, September Neural Computation magazine, and then discussed again in the Signal Processing magazine column about that time. What's new in today's paper is the last couple words in the title that says in interference. So we've done some more tests to see to what extent these kind of auditory model-based representations perform better than more conventional or MFCC-like representations in mixed sounds. So let me just describe what the representation is, since that's the main topic of this session. We start off with a cochlear simulation that produces this this thing we call the neural activity pattern. Oh, look at that. I get a cursor on both screens. The neural activity pattern, you can think of that as sort of a cochleogram or a representation of firing rate or firing probability of primary auditory neurons as a function of time and place, with high frequencies at the top here representing the base of the cochlea and low frequencies at the bottom or the apex of the cochlea. From those, we detect certain events called strobe events as a way to make an efficient and realistic computation of what Roy Patterson has dubbed the stabilized auditory image, which is a lot like the auditory correlogram that Malcolm and I did a lot of work on back in the 80s and 90s. Make these nice pictures that are stabilized in the sense that, you know, unlike this one that's kind of racing by with time, this one is like a triggered display on an oscilloscope where the trigger events cause it to stand still. So as you have pitch pulses, this central feature at zero time lag just stays there, and as the pitch period varies, these other ones that look like copies of it move back and forth to have a spacing equal to the pitch period. So you get these very nice looking dynamic movies here. The problem that we've often had with these over the years is figuring out how to go from this rich movie-like representation to some kind of features that we can use to do classification recognition tasks and things like that. Shortly after I started at Google in 2006, we were joined by Sammy Bengio, who had been doing very interesting work in image classification using a sort of high-dimensional sparse feature bag of visual words approach and a system trained with those. And when he described his system to me, I said, that's exactly what we need to analyze these movies of sounds and to get into a feature space on which we can train up classifiers. So what we've done is this next box we call multi-scale segmentation. It's kind of motivated by a lot of the work they do in the visual analysis, where they try to detect features all over the image at different scales and kind of different key points or other strategies based on just looking at regions of the image and saying which of several features that region is close to, and doing that at multiple scales. So we came up with a way to do that. We get a bunch of really just abstract features where there's they're sparse, so they're mostly zeros, and occasionally some of them get ones, and that sparse coding gives you for each frame of this movie this long vector of that has some ones in it but a lot of zeros. And then when we aggregate that over sound files, we just basically add those up. And so what you get here in the sum of all those sparse vectors is what's called a bag representation. It tells you how many times each feature occurred. It's just a histogram, really. So it's a count of how many times each of those abstract features occurred in a sound file. It's still relatively sparse, and that's the kind of feature vector that we use to represent a document. I go into these stages in a little bit more detail so you see what we do in there. The peripheral model, the cochlear simulation, is, if you know anything about my work, you know I've spent the last 30 years or so working on filter cascades as an approach to simulating the cochlea, because it's a way to connect kind of the underlying wave propagation hydrodynamics to an efficient digital signal processing filtering architecture in a way that lets you do both the good models of the quasi-linear filtering as well as easy ways to incorporate the nonlinear effects into that. So you get compression of dynamic range and generation of cubic distortion tones and stuff like that. It's basically just a cascade of these simple filter stages, some half-wave detectors that send, these represent inner hair cells and send a signal that represents instantaneous neuron firing probability, and a feedback network that, takes the output of the cochlea and sends it back to control the parameters of the filter stage. By reducing the Q of the filters, you can reduce the gain a lot. In a cascade like this, you don't have to change the Q or the bandwidth very much to change the gain a lot. So you get pretty nice compressive result from that. We stabilize the image using Roy Patterson's technique of strobed temporal integration, sort of like looking at an oscilloscope, as I mentioned, where each line of this image is independently triggered so that at this zero time interval you get this nice stable vertical feature. It doesn't really mean anything, it's just kind of a zero point, and the other stuff moves around relative to it as pitch changes and as formants go up and down and so on. So this is a frame of speech where the horizontal bands you see are resonances of the vocal tract or formants, and then the pattern that repeats in the time lag dimension are the pitch pulses. Other sounds that are less periodic than speech have different looking but still very interesting and kind of characteristic and unique kind of patterns. And the problem was to try to summarize a complex sound file using some statistics of these patterns in a way that you could do recognition and retrieval and so on. So we did a retrieval and recognition task that we've reported it in a couple of different contexts, but I'll show you the results in a second. The features that we extract from these stabilized auditory images are pulled out of a bunch of different boxes. We have, like, you know, long skinny boxes and short fat boxes and small boxes and big boxes, and within each box we for the current set of features we're using, we just do a sort of row and column marginals to reduce it to somewhat lower dimensionality, and then we vector quantize that, and we do that at a fixed resolution, like 32 rows and 16 columns, so it gives us a 48 dimensional feature vector for each one of those boxes, and then that 48 dimensions goes into a vector quantizer with different codebook for each different box size and position. So we get a whole bunch of codebooks doing a whole bunch of vector quantizations. The sizes can be quite large, up to several thousand per codebook, several hundred thousand dimensions total, sparse in the sense that only the one codebook that's closest gets a one and all the others get zeros. So we, for each frame of the video, we get you can think of this sparse code as being segmented, one segment for each codebook, and within each segment there's a single one. You could use any kind of a sparse code here, and when you accumulate that over the frames to make a summary for the whole document, you just add them up, as I said before. Again, that's the overview of the system. What we do at the end here is we go into this document. We take this document feature vector and we train up a ranking and retrieval system on that using Sammy Bengio's PEMIR system. That stands for passive-aggressive model for image retrieval. So we're doing the same thing for sound retrieval. His student David Granger is the lead author on that paper in 07. Basically, it computes a scoring function between a query and a audio document. The query Q here is a bag of words, the terms in a query. Like if I was searching for, say, fast car, it would look for audio documents that have a good score between the bag of words fast and car and the bag of abstract audio features that we have from that histogram. And that scoring function is computed as just a bilinear transformation. So there's a weight matrix that simply maps the audio, sparse audio features and the sparse query terms into this score for that query in that document. So all we have to do is train that weight matrix, and there's a simple stochastic gradient descent method for doing that. And it's actually, the nice thing about the PEMIR method is that algorithm is extremely fast, and we could do large data sets with it. So we were able to run many different experiments with variations on the features. This kind of scatter plot of many different variations on the auditory features, as well as a bunch of MFCC variants. The little X's here, mostly at one codebook size, but varying the number of MFCC coefficients and so on, and the window length, and a bunch of different things. And you can see here that the MFCC result is not too bad in terms of precision at top one and retrieval. We can beat it by a fair amount with very large code books and the auditory features, but the difference in terms of what we could do with the best MFCC and what we could do with the best auditory-based system here was kind of small. I was a little disappointed in that. So these are the results we reported before. The line on top is kind of the convex hull that shows that perhaps the most important thing here is just the size of the abstract feature space that you use with this method. It's nice that this matrix, when you get up here to 100,000 dimensions in your sparse feature vector, and you've got, say, 3,000 query terms, what does that come out to? 300 million elements that we're training in that matrix. You can train a 300 million parameter system here without overfitting it due to the nature of the regularized training algorithm. It actually works quite nicely. So what we did for the ICAST paper was to see how well this would work in interference. We actually took, from our database of sound files, we took pairs of files at random and added them together. So you might have a sound file whose tags say it represents a fast car and another one that says it's a barking dog or something like that. You add the files together, you've got both sounds in there. A person listening to it can still tell you what it is, typically, what the both things are. And so we took the union of the tags. We truncated the sound file just to the length of the shorter one because we noticed that in almost all cases, a few seconds of a sound was enough to tell you what it was, and an extra 30 seconds of fast car didn't really help you any, so it was just simplest to truncate everything. So we had sort of a nominal 0 dB signal-to-noise ratio, if you like, of if you consider one of the sounds to be the true sound and the other one to be interference. But then we did this same kind of ranking and retrieval task using Pamir to, say, given a query like fast car again, you still want to get that file that has the barking dog in it because it has the fast car tags. You don't want that barking dog to interfere too much with the retrieval. So we did that kind of test, and the result showed a much bigger difference between the best MFCC system and the best auditory stabilized auditory image-based system. So the punchline of this experiment is that the sparse-coded stabilized auditory images show a bigger advantage over MFCC for sounds in interference than for clean sounds. This is what we had hoped based on the idea that these boxes in the stabilized auditory image focusing on different regions will sometimes pick up regions where the sounds have separated out. So there's certain combinations of sort of frequency bands and time lag patterns that will be robust, that will represent that car and will still lead to the same code words, the same sparse feature, and, you know, same way with the dog. So the features for both sounds will be present in the sparse vector, even though other features may be wiped out by interference. So it's this locality in this higher dimensional space that we believe is was the motivation, and we believe is the explanation for this. So we don't have a great way to test or prove that yet. So in conclusion, the auditory representations do work pretty well. MFCCs work pretty well too if you run them through an appropriately powerful training system. And the sparse coding works well. And when you put these together, sparse codes that are somewhat localized in the stabilized auditory image space take advantage of how the auditory system separates certain features of sound, at least, at a fairly low level. Thank you.
Any questions?
So for the sparseness code to work on any kind of raw high dimensional signal, you need to have some evidence somehow, maybe some property in the original representation that the statistics of those mixed information versus those isolated information are such that it can facilitate the sparse code to get rid of those and use, you know, unhelpful information. It looks like you get a lot more, much richer information here than the original one. I mean, so the extreme case will go back to the waveform, right? That has all the information there. The question is, how are you able to tease apart these two different kinds of information?
Yeah, so the information is all there in the waveform, but it's not easily accessible directly to get a sparse code that corresponds to features of how you hear the sound. Similarly, in a short-time spectral representation like the MFCCs, a lot of the information is there, but some of it is lost by the sort of non-coherent spectral detection stuff, so that you no longer have an easy way to take advantage of the separation of things by pitch into different regions of the auditory image, pitches or other characteristic time patterns in these non-periodic sounds. So the idea was that this duplex representation that Licklider proposed for pitch captures a lot of different aspects of psychological pitch perception, and we thought that would be a better starting point than either short-time spectral or waveform as a way to pull out abstract features that correlate with what you hear. And we're not trying to suppress the interfering sounds. We're just trying to get a bag of features in which both sounds have some features come through.
Craig had a question while we switch laptops. Craig?
Yeah, thanks,
stand
Malcolm.
Up so we can continue talking.
Yeah, so I was just taking off on your comment at the start. So we've seen Nima present now cortical representation, scale, and you've got your stabilized auditory image. So you both have heard each other's talk. Would his model be something that you would consider trying to see how well it performs?
Yes and no. So my representations are sort of midbrain, brainstem, inferior colliculus probably. The cortical stuff that Nima has, it's amazing how well it works, like in his human experiments where he can resynthesize the spectrograms of the sound that the human is paying attention to. That sort of suggests that it's a representation that comes after some sound separation processing. And I think that is a layer we need to put in somehow explicitly before the cortical spectrotemporal receptive fields really make a lot of sense. If you get there directly without doing the separation first, I think you'll have the same problem as the other short-time spectral techniques in that interfering sounds won't be, the representation won't capture the differences between the features of the interfering sounds. You have to do some separation before you give up the fine time structure and go to a purely spectral or short-time spectral, spectrotemporal approach. There's something else that has to be done in there. So I was just talking to Morgan about that earlier, and Nima and I have talked before too, and we do want to figure out a way to put all these ideas together. It's just not clear exactly how to bridge that right now.
For those of you that are new to the area, the spectral versus temporal argument has been going on for a long time and hasn't been settled yet. Thanks, Dick.